May I have your attention, please? I'd like us to get started with our regular program. It's my pleasure to introduce our host today, which is former Ambassador Francis Rooney, and I think everybody already knows him either as the former ambassador to the Holy See appointed by George W. Bush, or perhaps as our former congressman. He's also been a very successful businessman and has been very involved in a number of issues. His resume is huge. And he's been married to Kathleen for many years, has three children, and I believe he either has just had a grandchild or is getting ready to have one or two grandchildren. So with that, I would like, oh, and one more thing I'd like to say about Francis is he's on our board. He's been on our board a few times. He serves on our board, and he's an executive committee member, and he's our current secretary. So, Francis, would you please come up and introduce our speaker?
Thank you, Susan. That was too kind. It is great to be back at the Forum Club and to see the club back in action. I missed it a lot, and I know everybody else did. It's a great honor for me to be able to introduce Alex Brill and to thank Bill Strong for his role in getting Alex as well. One of many things that Alex has done and does is involvement with the Alliance for Market Solutions, which I'm sure he'll talk about, that Bill is one of the founding board members of, and it's all CEOs trying to force responsible environmental solutions. Alex has done an awful lot for a young man. He's a senior fellow with the American Enterprise Institute. He's written two books, Carbon Tax Policy, A Conservative Dialogue, and Pro-Growth Opportunities is one of them. The other one is The Real Tax Burden, More Than Dollars and Cents, which I'm looking forward to reading that one. He has testified at Congress many times. He worked on the House Ways and Means Committee policy staff as policy director and chief economist. Before that, he was at the White House Council of Economic Advisors for President Bush, and he was also on the Simpson-Bowles Commission staff in 2008. Alex has an MA in mathematical finance from Boston University and a BA in economics from Tufts. He lives in Arlington, Virginia, with his wife, Johanna, who's sitting down here, and their two children, Rachel and Jonah. So let's give a great Forum Club welcome to our new friend, Alex Brill.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the kind introduction, Francis, and thank you, everyone, for being here today. It's a pleasure to be outside of Washington. It's a pleasure to be in a beautiful place like Naples, Florida. I want to thank everyone. I want to thank Bill Strong in particular for helping facilitate this invitation, and for Susan, for your leadership of the Forum Club, and for Ellie for helping with all the logistics and making everything work so well for me and for my wife, Joanna. I want to thank Joanna for being here. I've been speaking publicly for roughly 20 years of my career to different groups inside and outside of Washington. This is the first time that my wife has been here and joined me in an event like this. So if I seem nervous, it's only because of her. It's not because of you. I also want to acknowledge all the students who were up here earlier and who are here today, and I know that there are always students at this event. To those of you, I see you sitting around these tables. You all just did a great job standing up in front of a large audience. At first, I was a little nervous because I was coming up here after Nikki Haley. Now I'm nervous because I was coming here up after a bunch of students who have great futures ahead of them, who were poised and clear in their remarks, and it's inspirational to hear you talk about yourselves and talk about your accomplishments and talk about your dreams and your goals. You have clear focus for what you want to do and what you have done in your short life so far, and you're looking forward into the future. And I think for everyone in this room, it's optimistic for us to hear your remarks. So thank you for what you said, and thank you for being here. I've got two kids myself, as the ambassador noted, who are your ages, and so I know what, and they're great kids, and so I know what great kids are like, and I know how well my kids would speak in front of this microphone. So I know that you guys all did a great job, and thank you. I'm here today to make the case for meaningful public policy to address climate change. I'm here to make that case that those policies should be market-based. And this should be the objective of all policymakers. So I'll be making a conservative case. I'm a fiscal conservative. I'm a conservative. I worked for Republicans on Capitol Hill and in the executive branch, and I work at a right-of-center think tank. So I'll be making that case for climate policy from that perspective, as someone who has thought about this for a number of years and thinks about government as something that should be limited as a general matter. But we are looking at an issue that I think is important and worthy of a policy. And not just any policy, but smart policy. And so I will try to talk about what smart policy is with respect to climate change. I want to talk generally just about three things. And I will probably speak quickly just so that we can finish on time. The first thing I want to talk about is the consequences of climate change. And so there's lots and lots of ways one could speak for a long time just about the expected consequences of climate change. I think in that remark, if we did that for a long time, we'd want to talk about the uncertainty of those forecasts. And I'll touch on that a little bit. But I think we need to talk about what the consequences are of this issue and not just say it, but describe it. The second thing I'll do is I'll try to lift your spirits a little bit, and I'll try to offer a little bit of good news, that there are some things that are happening in our energy economy that are encouraging, and that our economy is dynamic and adaptable and can change and can change in the future as well with respect to energy and climate. And third, I'm going to turn to the policy issues itself. And so I will make the case that policy, that we need policy, that we should be doing something. And that's not always the case. Not every problem deserves a government intervention or a government solution, but that this one does. I'll speak about some of the ways we can frame the types of policies that we could consider. So one of the things that irks me sometimes when politicians talk about climate change is they say things like, oh, we're going to tackle it. Well, I don't know what that means, right? That doesn't mean anything. Tackling climate change doesn't mean anything. We need to be specific. So I'll talk a little bit about the types of policies, which will lead naturally to what I think is the right answer. And some of you, I think, will agree, and some of you may disagree, and that's quite fine. We'll talk about that. And then if we still have time, I'll talk a little bit about the politics of climate change. Because when we're talking about public policy, when we're talking about solutions that come from government, we have to be aware of the politics that make this issue difficult. So let's start. So first, the consequences of climate change. Again, we could speak about this in a lot of different ways. I will note just a few things on the science. But first, a caveat. I'm not a climate scientist. So I'm not expert in the mechanics, the molecular mechanics of climate change. I'm going to rely on those experts, those scientists who study the how of climate change. But I'll comment on it so that we can set the stage before we get to a policy discussion. So climate scientists, their sort of standard framework for measuring climate change is to measure the change in the average surface temperature of the Earth. And I find this a particularly dissatisfying way of talking about climate change. But this is what, when we read about climate change, this is what we read about. 1 degree Celsius, 1.5 degrees Celsius, 3 degrees Celsius. First of all, they're talking about it in Celsius, so I'm already confused. But second of all, they're talking about a metric that doesn't really mean very much to me. But nevertheless, that's the standard in which that scientists have agreed. Now, I'll tell you this of what I understand of the science. The science that I understand about climate change is that carbon dioxide emissions that occur as a result of anything, right, doesn't matter why or how or where, that carbon dioxide is emitted into the atmosphere, and then in a fairly linear sense, with a linear relationship between the quantity of emissions in a given period of time, linear relationship between that and this metric of preference of scientists, the average surface temperature of the Earth. So the more emissions there are, with a lag, you get more, you get an increase in temperature. The relationship is the following. 1,000 gigatons of carbon dioxide emissions into the air in a fixed period of time will result in about 0.5 degree Celsius, whatever that is, about 0.5 degree Celsius, 1/4 degree Fahrenheit, increase in this metric. I don't know what 1,000 gigatons of carbon dioxide looks like, but I do know that since about the 1850s, we've had about 2,500 gigatons of emissions into the atmosphere. And so as a result, we have had climate change already. We will in the future looking forward, we will have additional emissions, and those additional emissions, along with the lag effects of the emissions that we're having at the moment and have had recently, we're going to have additional climate change, and we're going to have additional increases. We don't know exactly what that quantity of future emissions will be. It could be, in a very optimistic world, half a ton, 500 gigatons. It could be 2 or 3 times as much or 4 times as much of that. And so we will continue to have climate change. This, I think, raises the important question, the obvious important question, which is, so what, right? So what if it's 1 degree warmer on average at the surface of the planet? A few responses to that question. First of all, I think it's important to acknowledge that in any of the forecasts, any of the answers to the so what question, there is some uncertainty. Some uncertainty of exactly what those consequences be. But there is not uncertainty, I believe, with respect to the direction of that consequence. So it's not like it might be good and it might be bad. We're not really sure. Let's wait and see. The answer is that we're going to have more emissions. We're going to have more warming. We're going to have higher temperatures, and we're going to have bad consequences. With certainty, we're going to have bad consequences. So let me touch on what those consequences will be, and I'll try to do this briefly. There will be lots of climate consequences beyond this sort of unintelligible metric about the average surface temperature of the Earth. But there will be consequences beyond just direct climate effects. There will be geopolitical consequences, and there will be my favorite, economic consequences. I say favorite because that's the world that I spend most of my time thinking about. So let me just pick on each one of those real quick. So thinking about climate effects specifically. So instead of talking about degrees Celsius on average, here's a fact. Today, 5% of the world experiences a severe heat wave. Right, the kind of heat wave where people die, a severe heat wave, in a 20-year period. We have heat waves, you know, we don't have them all the time, they don't happen everywhere, but 5% of the world in a 20-year period will experience a severe heat wave, where they'll experience a drought and they'll lose crop and they will lose life. If the average surface temperature of the Earth increases by 2 degrees Celsius, more than a third of the planet will experience a severe heat wave in a 5-year period. So significant, dramatic changes in climate. It's not a degree here or a degree there, but real consequences in some places. Let's think not just about the actual literal climate effects. There are geopolitical effects. There are geopolitical risks that will change as a result of climate change. So the NIC, which is the National Intelligence Council, which is part of the ODNI, which is the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence is the agency that sits above all of our intelligence community, sits above the CIA and our other and their sister agencies, and coordinates the policy for the intelligence community in the United States. A part of the ODNI office is this National Intelligence Council, the NIC. And last month, the NIC issued a report, a declassified report for the public on climate change. And they worry about this issue, and they identified the risks from their perspective. They're not climate scientists. They consulted with climate scientists. But they consider these risks from a geopolitical perspective. And they talked at length. It's a very readable report. It's on the internet. You can find it if you Google it. They talk at length about the changes that they're anticipating as a result of climate change. Water is a huge problem for them, for the intelligence community, for our geopolitical stability, because there will be less of it in really important parts of our world. And there'll be more of it, more than we want in other parts. So we will have droughts and flooding. That will create political instability. That will create mass migration events. Millions of people moving quickly from one country into another country, rapidly depopulating and populating new countries and communities. That will create shortages and tensions and upheaval. It will impact not only the demand for humanitarian assistance, but it will destabilize some countries' political systems. The NIC report draws attention to 11 countries that will feel particular impacts, not just the 11 worst countries with respect to climate change, but the 11 countries that they, from a geopolitical perspective, worry about and are at risk for climate change. Those countries include Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, Iraq, North Korea, Guatemala, Haiti, Honduras, Nicaragua, Colombia. These are countries that we are already worried about. Climate change is going to make the political situation in those countries worse and will create risks for us here at home. And then the third way we can think about climate change, and of the many ways that we can think about climate change, is in economic terms. And this is the way that's easiest for me to think about it. And so there's something going on, it's been going on, it's going to continue to go on, that will create change in our economy. Climate change will create economic change. It will create winners and losers to some degree. I think Elon Musk is probably a winner from climate change, right? We're moving towards a lot of green and energy efficient and new technologies, and it is creating winners, but it is creating losers as well. I think about this from an economic perspective of output, which is maybe the most basic way that economists talk about the economy, which is how much stuff do we make? So there's a range of estimates of the consequences of climate change with respect to the economy, but here's the one that I like. The Congressional Budget Office, which is a pretty straight arrow, middle-of-the-road organization in Washington, one of the few remaining perhaps, has asked this question: what happens as a result of climate change to the U.S. economy? And the answer that they provide, their best guess, is 1%. 1% smaller economy in the year 2050. As a result of climate change. And then the next question is, is that a big deal or a little deal? And I would suggest to you, that is a really big deal. 1% is about $250 billion in less output. Not $250 billion in real estate losses or things that are destroyed as a result of a storm, but less output in the year 2050 and every year thereafter, forever. So we're permanently smaller by that amount. The other 99% of our economy will hold up, and that's the good news. But 1% is actually no joke when in Washington and in public policy. When we pursue public policies to fix our roads or better educate our children or reform our entitlement systems, any of the big policy issues that we're looking at, we're hoping for 1% gain. Tax reform is not going to make our economy 50% bigger. It's going to make our economy a couple of percentage points bigger. And so when we do nothing to address climate change, we are hurting ourselves by that order of magnitude. And I think that in part helps justify the need for a policy. I haven't said which policy, and I think which policy really matters. But I'll get to that in a minute. So Here's maybe a little bit of good news, right? Because I just told you about a big problem, and there are a lot of things that are big problems in our world. This is only one of them. So I wanted to try to find something that's a little bit more positive to share. And I think that there is. I think with respect to our energy economy in the United States, there is change that has been occurring that we should be acknowledge. This progress, and we should be proud of it, and we should learn from it how dynamic our economy can be. So just a couple of three quick factoids on this point. The amount of energy that's required in the U.S. economy to produce a dollar of output, right? So we run factories, we run whatever we run, we use energy as an input in production in our U.S. economy, and then we generate output. So for a given amount of output, we're using 40% less energy in this country per output, per dollar of output, than we were in 2020. 2020 was not that long ago. So in 20 years, we've cut our demand for energy per unit of GDP by, I meant to say 30%. That's the first one. Second, is that energy, those BTUs that we're using in our economy, they're greener and cleaner than they were 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, there were 60 million metric tons of carbon dioxide emitted into the atmosphere for every quadrillion BTUs. And I don't know what a quadrillion BTU look like. But that's the ratio, right? 60 per quadrillion. 60 million per quadrillion. Today, it's 50 million metric tons of CO2. So we're becoming cleaner and greener in our energy. And that's meaningful progress. And then the third thing is we can bring those two factoids together, the energy per GDP and the CO2 per energy, and we can say that carbon dioxide per unit of GDP, per unit of output in our economy, is dropping. And it's declined 40% since the year 2000. Now, this doesn't mean that we don't have a problem. This doesn't mean that we can just step back and sit back and do nothing and it'll work itself out. What it means to me is that our economy is dynamic, right? It's flexible. It's adapting. It can respond. And so that gives me both, you know, it could be much worse today than it is, and it gives me hope looking forward that our economy can continue to evolve as in the face of reasonable policies. The reason that those numbers don't tell a wonderful story is because our economy is growing at the same time. There's more of us and we're making more stuff. So we're more efficient per dollar of output. But there is, again, the good news, much more output. We are a much bigger economy than we were 20 years ago. And for that reason, our total emissions are not falling to the same degree as the statistics that I just offered. Our total emissions have declined because we've made gains faster than our economic growth. But looking forward, things are more likely to plateau here in the United States with respect to emissions. And in fact, among all developed nations, we should expect, again, depending on innovation, depending on policy, relatively constant CO2 emissions in the coming decades. Unfortunately, our less developed nations of the world will be increasing emissions as they grow. They'll be growing faster than the developed world. That's sort of one of the definitions of a less developed nation is it's one that grows more quickly as it chases the more developed world. Their emissions will be increasing rapidly. And these issues, these global policy issues are important to consider. So let me just recap real quick and then we'll pivot to the policy. So when I think about the points I was just trying to drive home, it's that climate change has occurred, is real, and is causing all sorts of consequences besides just the direct climate consequences, geopolitical and economic as well. And now let's shift a little bit and say, okay, so what are we going to do? So I've spent over 20 years in Washington, and as Ambassador Rooney noted in his introduction, I worked on Capitol Hill. I worked at the sort of the forefront of the congressional, one of the leading congressional committees, and I worked in the executive branch. And I've been around a lot of lawmakers, and then worked in a think tank, and had the opportunity to advise a lot of policymakers and a lot of lawmakers, and understood the trade-offs between the politics and the policy that many of our elected officials face. And I've come to through those experiences to think, had the opportunity to think and develop these ideas about how should one approach a new and significant problem if you're a policymaker. And so the first question, and I think I alluded to this earlier, is the question of, okay, we have a problem, I get that, but should we do anything about it? We can't solve all our problems with government interventions, right? Sometimes, and this is my view, my political view for sure, you know, many times the medicine is worse than the disease, right? The cure is worse than the disease. The intervention causes more unintended consequences. And so sometimes we have problems that we're just going to need to live with. And that if we try to fix each one of them, particularly at the federal level, we might end up worse off overall. And so that's my bias, right? Not everybody feels that way, but I feel that way. And so when I come to an issue like this, I think we should start by saying, okay, we have a problem, but does that mean we need to do something about it? And I think that the answer in this case is yes. And I think the answer is yes, because I think the problem is clear. And I think that there are some solutions, not all solutions, but some solutions that are clear as well. And so let me just speak sort of like in economic terms about how I visualize this problem, right, of climate change. What's the economics of that problem? So I think about it this way. When I go to the gas station and fill my gas tank, I pay a certain price. The price that I pay, the price at the pump, reflects just the cost that guy had to pay to buy the gasoline, the cost that guy has to pay to operate his station, and a little bit extra for, you know, a little bit of markup, a little bit of profit. That's what the price is. That's where the price comes from. It's just the price he paid plus a little bit more. For me, my choice, my decision whether or not I'm going to fill up that tank and pay that price is just about what I'm going to get out of having a tank full of gas. And so what I'm going to get out of it is I'm going to go to the supermarket and I'm going to go to work and maybe I'll get to go on vacation with that gas or whatever it is. And if it's $3 or $4 a gallon, I'm going to pay. Right? And so he's charging the price that, you know, his price plus a little bit more. And my willingness to pay just reflects the fact that I will get more, at least, or more benefit from that tank of gas than what I paid for it. So if it costs me $50, I pay it because I'm getting something in return that I'm happy to pay. It might be more than I wish, it might be more than it used to be, but that's the transaction. And so there's nothing evil or wrong or immoral about the gas station guy who's selling me gas, and there's nothing evil about me just completing that transaction and buying that gas. But what I understand from climate policy, and the reason I'm advocating for an intervention is not only because there are consequences, but because I can clearly define what the problem is. The problem is that when I take that tank of gas and drive around to the supermarket or to the office or out on vacation or to pick up my kids or wherever it may be, I'm emitting a little bit of CO2. And whether I do that or not is not going to change the average global surface temperature of the Earth. But if all of us emit it, right, the aggregate effect is this negative externality. It's this cost. And that cost isn't reflected in that transaction. And that's the market failure. It's not quite a failure. I mean, we call it a market failure. It's really just a market imperfection. So the price of gasoline is pretty close to correct, except that there's this other cost that's associated with the burning of fossil fuel that's not captured in that transaction. And so the point I mean to make is that I can define the problem. When I think about whether or not we need a policy solution, you have to be able to define the problem. And in this case, I think you can. Second, let me just say, what types of policies? Right? Let me dig a little bit deeper into the policy answer. What types of policies should we be pursuing? So some people say all of the above or everything, or they say something super vague like tackle climate change, which doesn't mean anything, as I said, or there's nothing that should be off the table. So that's not how I think about it. I think about policy as needing to be very clear, very well defined, and very efficient as possible. So a couple of different ways that one can think about the policy, and then I'll get to the policy that I like the best. First of all, we can think about climate policies that are adaptations, and we can think about policies that are mitigation related. So adaptation policies, that just means climate change is happening, our world is being affected, and therefore we need to change something. We need to build a seawall, right? We need to relocate a bridge. We need to reinforce some of our physical infrastructure. We need to develop drought-resistant crops, right? Those are all ways to adapt to climate change. And maybe we need to do that because climate change is happening. Mitigation is trying to stem or slow or address the root of the problem, trying to reduce the emissions. And we can think about policies to reduce emissions so that we have less climate change, or we can think about policies to adapt to the climate change that's happening. Mike's a little hot here. Maybe I'm starting to yell. I'm getting excited here. And we can think about both, right? We may need to think about both. Second, we need to think about our policies in terms of where in the government these policies are being pursued. They could be pursued locally. I'm generally a big advocate of local policies. They could be pursued globally. And we could say, well, global climate change is a global issue. If we emit less but China emits more, we're not any better off. We need to think about this at a global level. And I would suggest, with respect to climate, that there are solutions at all levels of government. I think it's really difficult, as we've seen, to get global solutions. On the other hand, local mitigation strategies are not that effective. But local adaptation strategies may be very effective, right? So who would know best about where to build a seawall might be the local community to know best. The third way we can think about policies is we can think about policies that are innovation related, or we can think about policies that are deployment related. So innovation related says, well, we're going to need better battery technology. We're just going to need better batteries if we're going to have a cleaner, greener, you know, solar wind type energy framework. And we don't know how to do that yet. So we need R&D. We need tax credits for R&D. We need federal funding for R&D. We need to invent more and better stuff that's cleaner and greener, more energy efficient. Deployment strategies say, we have pretty good technologies. You know, the price of solar is down 90%. The price of wind is down 90% since some of these technologies were first invented. We just need more people to buy them. And so then we talk about tax credits and mandates and other rules to kind of get the existing technologies. We can think about either one of or both of those kinds of policies. And finally, we can think about those policies being market-based or being directed government interventions. And my view is we should be thinking about policies that are market-based. Even if we say, as I said a moment ago, the market's not operating perfectly, that doesn't mean that we should necessarily abandon the market and let someone else make all of the decisions about how we're going to have a cleaner economy and environment. Maybe we can adjust the free market and improve the incentives in the free market and capture that ability to continue to make the kind of progress that we've made over the last 20 years and make that progress faster in the next 20 years. Now let me talk about the policy that you're all here to hear about today. Let me talk about, but before I say what it is, I guess it's already been revealed, I'll just step back for one more second about my own background. Before I was involved in this issue at all, for the last 24 years, I've been working as a tax guy, as a tax policy researcher, both inside and outside the government. So when I worked on the House Ways and Means Committee, where all tax measures originate in the U.S. Congress, I worked as their chief economist focused on tax policy, primarily focused on tax policy that makes the economy grow faster. And one of the things that I learned, and you may know this already, about tax policy, is that people don't really like taxes, right? And so that's really important. You don't actually need to be a tax policy expert to know that, but I've studied tax policy for 20 years, and I can tell you, people would rather pay less than pay more, mostly. There are a few exceptions, but generally that's true. So, why then is my answer to the climate challenge that we face, why is it a tax answer? I'm an advocate for a carbon tax, for putting a price on carbon, for changing the price that you pay for gasoline at the pump to reflect all the costs that are incurred in that transaction, that acquisition of a tank of gasoline. Not only the costs that are reflected in the transaction today, to capture all the costs, the social cost, the negative externality of CO2 emissions. I want to tax all of that CO2. The reason I want to do that, there are lots of reasons, I could talk about them for a while, but the one that I want to share today is because people don't like taxes. So it's a wonderful marriage of policy. Because what we want is we want to reduce CO2 emissions, which people will really try to do if there's a tax associated with it. That's the policy that's going to harness so many actions across our economy. And so maybe I buy a slightly different car, or maybe I drive a little bit more efficiently, maybe I, you know, insulate my house, all these little micro decisions that I might make. But it's not only at the household level, it's at the business level, it's at the electric utility level. The guys who run electric utilities, they hate taxes too, just like the rest of us. So they're going to try to figure out how to make electricity and pay less tax, meaning emit less CO2 into the atmosphere. And so it's my hatred, probably your hatred of tax policy, that I think makes me believe that we should marry that annoying concept of taxation with the unfortunate consequences of carbon dioxide. There are lots of other details. This is a market-based solution. This allows everyone to adjust to this change. And one of the big issues, especially as a conservative, is this question, whoa, we're paying enough taxes already. We don't need more taxes, which is kind of true, except we're spending way more than we're taxing, so we do have a deficit problem. But take that a given, is that we don't need more on net taxes, if that was true. Maybe it's true. The question is what are we going to do with the money? And then is that a positive or a negative? So a carbon tax could raise $1 trillion, no problem. An easy, like simple, regular, moderate, modest carbon tax is going to be $1 trillion over the decade. So now we have $1 trillion. So is that $1 trillion problem or $1 trillion opportunity? For me, it's $1 trillion opportunity to cut $1 trillion of other taxes. Now maybe you say, well, that's not how Washington works. That's not how the politicians today are going to deal with it. And I think that that's a debate and a fight to have, that's worth having, right? What to do with the money. And so I think the strongest skepticism to a carbon tax is your belief that the monies will be poorly used. But it is also an opportunity. It is an opportunity for the adaptation financing. It's an opportunity to address our deficit. It's an opportunity to reduce other taxes that are more harmful to the economy overall. And let me wrap up and talk a little bit about the politics of climate change. So the politics, as I see them, on climate change and climate climate change action, you know, policies to climate change, look like this. Among Democrats have been long concerned about the risks of climate change. I think that's fair to say. Unfortunately, what I see their solutions that are being advocated today, they are moving away from, they are starting to abandon these market-based policy solutions, like carbon pricing or another similar idea like cap and trade, which I think is inferior. And they're still concerned about the science, but they're moving away from those types of solutions towards more command and control solutions. They're giving up on the market. Republicans, as I see them, are waking to the risk of climate change. They're increasingly concerned. They're hearing it from their constituents. They're hearing it from their staff. They're hearing it from advocates who are educating them. And more Republicans are concerned about climate change. And they're looking for sensible strategies. They're, in my experience, are oftentimes looking for the same types of policy changes that Democrats are now moving away from. So Democrats were interested. They had some market-based solutions. They weren't acting, but they were talking. Now they're moving towards less market-based solutions. Republicans are kind of coming a little bit later into this area of interest, and they are looking for market-based solutions. And there's a policy mismatch between the two parties. Lo and behold, no surprise. I would also note that there is opposition within both parties to these types of solutions, both parties, right? So I think it's difficult for Democrats to move aggressive policy reforms due to their narrow majorities and lawmakers in states like Texas, Louisiana, and West Virginia, where they're very concerned about the short-term impacts on their constituents that may be negative. So neither party has a majority. So this might lead you to suggest, well, this would be a great opportunity for bipartisanship. Remember bipartisanship? So once upon a time in Washington, when there were big problems, there was bipartisanship, and parties cast aside their politics, and they sort of held hands, and they jumped off the cliff together, and that way they couldn't fight each other in the next election over that issue, because they both voted for that thing that kind of was difficult, that created winners and losers, and that was bipartisanship. And so a lot of people say, we need to recreate that. We need to work hard to rebuild that center, that core in our political system. And one of the reasons is we need to do that to tackle climate change. And one of the reasons we need to do it particularly for climate change is because we need durable climate policy. So we don't want to have an environment where one party enacts a climate policy, whether it's a sensible one or a stupid one, and then the other party just runs to repeal that policy. That's not going to be good for the climate, right? We don't need more of that. So what we need is this bipartisanship. I will suggest that is not the road ahead for us. This is not going to be the thing where we're not in a political world where we're going to find that in the near term, that hand-holding across the aisle as they sort of jump off the cliff and price carbon together. I believe that we will have serious climate policy in the future, hopefully in the near term, and I think that it'll be driven by one party, not by both parties. I think that the time that will happen will be at the moment when we evolve from debating if we have a problem, which is sort of where we still are. Some people think we do. Not everyone thinks we do. When we get to the point, we're headed to the direction, when we get to the point where there's real consensus that there's a climate policy, at that point, we're going to have two different solutions. We're going to have the solution from the right and the solution from the left. And who's ever in charge at that time will jam through their solution on a party line vote. I think that these market-based solutions like pricing carbon are the ones that will protect our economy as well as protect our environment. The alternative solutions, the sort of regulatory command and control strategies, may protect our environment, but will seriously damage our freedoms and seriously damage our economy. And who's in charge at the time when that decision happens will be the party that gets to determine what type of solution we have. I know I'm running out of time, but I want to give one precedent for that example. The precedent, for those of you who may be familiar with a program called Medicare, in particular a program called Medicare Part D. Medicare Part D is your prescription drug benefit. You didn't always have it. Prior to 2005, there was no prescription drug coverage for Medicare. It's hard for me, honestly, I worked on that policy. It's hard for me to imagine that seniors were given health insurance by the government and they weren't given drug coverage. But now they are. That legislation, that expansion of the federal government, the Federal Safety Net Program, was achieved under the Bush administration. Republicans, on a party line vote, created Medicare Part D. And they did it in a market-based way. We have a market-based prescription drug benefit plan. It is different from the rest of Medicare. And that was highly political, but it would happen at a time where both parties decided that it was a policy that was necessary, and the party in charge decided how that policy was going to be implemented. And they did it, in my view, the best way possible. They did it in a market-based way policy. So I think we'll see a similar thing with respect to climate change, and it just depends on who's in charge. So with that, I want to, again, thank everyone for listening. I hope maybe I changed a mind or two. Maybe I made somebody a little bit upset, and that's okay, too. I'm looking forward to a little bit of Q&A and talking a little bit further. So thanks very much.
We have a gift for you for taking time to come speak to us from the Forum Club of Southwest Florida.
Thank you very much. The colors of Naples.
Okay. We may have an all-time record of questions. I don't know if we'll get to all of them, but I'll try.
Blue is good and white is bad?
Here's a market-based student question. How do you plan to set the price, carbon tax? Making it too expensive will cause the wealth gap to increase, while making it too cheap will allow more affluent groups to neglect the tax.
Sure. So the idea, I didn't talk about the price of carbon. I just said a price, a non-zero price. And what price to set is one of the hardest questions for policymakers. The scientists have thought about this price. They call it the social cost of carbon. Some people think it's relatively low, like $15 or $20 a ton. Some people think it's relatively high, like $80 or $100 a ton. My view is start with something that's not zero. So my view would be start on the low end. I'd start with a $20 a ton carbon tax. And then we'll see what the responses are. You know, we escalate that tax over time as prices rise and see how the economy evolves. So we want the lowest necessary price to get the changes that we're looking for.
Okay. How do we account for all of the major changes and disasters that took place millions of years ago before civilization? There have always been cycles in climate change.
Absolutely. That is definitely the case. So a lot of this has to do with man-made efforts, right? You know, factories, our cars, our electric grid, and those pollutions. But that's not to say that that's the only thing that's going on. So there are short cycles and long cycles in the climate, and they're changing, and there are waves, and periods get warmer, and periods get closer. The scientists need to disentangle those two effects, and when they do, they find that there is an effect that is a result of industrialization of CO2 emissions. That's the part that I think we want to tackle. The other parts are real and true and will continue even if we're successful.
I've read that nuclear energy is the cleanest and most efficient fuel. Is that true? And should we incentivize nuclear, or are the concerns related to past disasters still applicable?
So a lot of this, I'm a big advocate of nuclear power, and I really wish that we could have a lot more of it in the United States. We have an aging nuclear power fleet, and over time we will have less and less nuclear power as we're regulatory required to retire some of that fleet. We're trying to extend the life of some of the capacity that we have. At the same time, there's been tremendous innovation, technological growth. We could have a lot more nuclear power. It's obviously, it's an always-on energy, so it's very consistent, unlike wind and solar. And most of the challenges there are related to perceptions from past events and the politics of nuclear power, not the science of nuclear power.
Okay, here's another student question. What can we do to help you and many others out there spreading the word about climate change? What can we do at home, and what do you think the government will begin to do about climate change? Where will they start?
It's a great question. That's a hard question. Well, how do we go from where we are to a different space? So there are some, you know, I think of those what we can do questions kind of in two buckets. There's the real stuff that we can do, and then there's the fake stuff we can do. And I'm concerned sometimes about some of the fake stuff. I don't mean fake like disingenuous, but, you know, I worry about pledges to be green. I worry about CEOs saying that they, you know, upgraded their HVAC systems in their corporations and therefore, you know, everything's okay or going to be okay. I think we need policy. I think it's more than just our own personal actions. It's more than just putting, you know, the paper in the blue bin and calling it recycling and thinking that we're going to be different. The answer, the real answers come from bigger and broader policies. And so the action to take is to make your politicians aware of your feelings, aware of your concerns. It's to engage and make that a priority for yourself so that it's a priority for them.
If the government collects the carbon tax, who guarantees that it will be spent where intended?
You do. You do, because it's your government. It's our government, because we elected those people. We elect those people. Now, it's a super good question, and it's one of the things that I worry about. How do we know that the money is going to be used the right way? It could be used for climate ways. It could be used to cut other taxes, as I talked about. There's no guarantee, and it's a legitimate concern. And so we need to work on a host of governance issues, because we have a government that is spending more and more and spending money that it can't afford. And I understand that risk, but I worry about the alternatives, which are more damaging to our economy.
Do you believe the polar shift is on its way? And if so, should we all get out of Florida?
I don't know. But you should not get out of Florida, and I don't know if the polar shift is underway.
Here's a student question. How does the carbon tax affect or limit small businesses?
So the carbon tax is going to affect everybody, small businesses, medium-sized businesses, large businesses, households. It's going to change a lot of things, a little bit, right? This is not saying that there's no more coal. We're not saying there's no more natural gas. We're not shutting things down. We're not imposing large costs on one segment. We're imposing a small cost on all segments. And what I believe about our economy is that it's adaptable. And so it will change. And so small businesses will adjust. They'll become more energy efficient. They'll become, they'll adjust their prices. They'll adjust how they do business.
What is the best recent book on climate change? Not on ideological tone, but factual and science-based.
Oh, I hate book recommendation questions. I haven't seen the book. I might write a book. I don't know. I haven't seen a book on climate. I mean, there's a lot of books on climate change. I mean, the IPCC working groups out of the United Nations, their stuff is super readable. The publication from the intelligence community that I referenced earlier is super readable. These are shorter documents. I read the Bill Gates book. I did not find that very interesting or impressive. So I think we don't have good, to my ear, at least as a reader, enough good resources.
We're getting down to just a couple more. We're not going to make it through all these, I don't think. How can we believe electric vehicles are green, knowing that with the problems of titanium, and I would throw in lithium ion in there, batteries, and how will we dispose of them when they're in their useful life?
I don't know. I think that's a great question. I think that we need to be thinking about not only the... You know, there is, I think, a misconception that just because there's nothing coming out of the tailpipe of a Tesla doesn't mean that it's therefore 100% clean. There's the production of those, and I'm not picking on Tesla, but I mean, there's the production side that we need to be aware of and concerned of. There are the rare elements that are involved in the battery technologies. And then there's this fact that that electricity isn't clean either, right? I mean, if you're burning coal to create the electricity to charge your electric vehicle, you're in the chain, there's emissions, no question. So those are not perfect solutions. Those are components of a bigger strategy.
Okay, we'll ask the last student question here. What has caused such a significant decrease in admissions, 30% since 2000, and why can't this process be used to continue to decrease emissions? And instead of using carbon tax revenue to reduce other taxes, could it possibly be put towards further reducing emissions and infrastructure for clean energy?
Yeah. So let me take the last one first. So for a long time, I was a pure play carbon tax advocate, meaning all we need is a carbon tax. We don't need any of this other regulatory framework. We don't need any of the subsidies. We don't need any of the rules. We only need the market to work. And I still pretty much believe that, but as I become increasingly concerned about climate change, I start to think that maybe we need some combination policies, like using some of the revenues to address additional emission reductions. That would also be the case if we could only have a small tax, or a suboptimal tax. We might take the revenues from that and use those revenues to help reduce demand for fossil fuels as well. So we can think about combination policies in addition to a pure carbon tax policy.
Okay. let's do this as the last one. It's 131. If sea level levels are truly rising, why would Speaker Pelosi buy a beachfront house in the free state of Florida?
I don't have to answer that, right?
Oh, yeah. That's why you get the big bucks.
I guess you have one more new resident coming, so maybe that says something about her political future.
I guess we could say we know she can swim.
Yeah. There you go.
Okay, that's 132. So thank you, Alan.
All right.
I appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much. Good. All right. Thank you very much. This is a lot of fun.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Enjoy Naples.
Well, I want to thank everybody for coming, and he was wonderful. And I want to wish you all a safe, healthy, and happy holiday season. January 7th at the Ritz on the Beach, please. Look forward to seeing everyone. We're adjourned.